This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
So the votes are split in lots of different directions. It's not the case that Reform are at 50% in the polls. They're at about 30% in the polls. But 30 is still bigger than anybody else. And under the first past the post system, the party that gets more votes than anyone else, even if it's not getting a majority of votes, tends to do pretty well. And that's where Reform is at the moment.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week, we see the landmark of 100 days of Reform UK in charge of Kent County Council. Chancellor Rachel Reeves came to a Kent caravan park and didn't cry. And the fallout from Tory MP Adam Holloway's defection to Reform UK shows no sign of dying down. My name is Simon Finlay. I'm the local democracy reporter for Kent County Council. And I'm joined by Dan Ison, who covers the borough and district councils in Kent.
Hello.
And Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway Council.
Hello.
And senior news editor Nikki White, who'll be talking about what's happening in Westminster.
Hello.
And this week's guest is the pollster Martin Baxter from Electoral Calculus, who will be trying to make some sense of our topsy-turvy politics here in Kent and beyond. First up, Dan, what have you been looking at this week?
So I've actually revisited a very long-fated regeneration programme in Herne Bay. It's a pretty major redevelopment of the former Tivoli Arcade and the surrounding Beach Street area, which has been in the works since 2018 when the council bought that building for more than £1 million. But it's been delayed ever since. And last week, the council finally put things back into motion for good.
Yeah, so why was it delayed for so long and why have the plans changed?
So the original plan was for 33 affordable homes behind the derelict arcade, as well as 4,000 square foot of commercial space in the nearby area and some flats at the front. But the former arcade's only been partially demolished. Plans for the rest of it have been consistently sort of knocked back. Basically, the whole project was put on the back burner by the pandemic. They bought it in 2018. They put out a contract to fulfil the works in 2020. And then obviously the pandemic happened, so nobody ended up fulfilling the work. Under the new plans, which they finally got to, the rest of the arcade is going to be demolished first and then converted into 6 apartments and commercial space. And the second phase is still meant to include 33 affordable homes. But the council's own documents say that the second phase isn't particularly financially viable at the moment.
Okay, and how are they planning to do it?
Well, Homes England sometimes provide money to councils if they do developments which are 100% affordable housing. They're going to do the first phase first, constructing a few nice apartments and some business space, and then pretty much it looks like they're banking on getting Homes England support or support from somebody else to help deliver the rest of it.
Okay, thanks, Dan. Robert, what's been going on in Medway?
This week saw another visit from the Chancellor Rachel Reeves, who came to the Haven Kent Coast Holiday Park at All Hallows out on the Hoo Peninsula. She was there to celebrate the huge investment which Haven and their parent company Blackstone have been making since 2021, including £140 million this year across the country, with about £40 million for the All Hallows site over the past 4 years. This includes £10 million on a new swimming pool, which is to open this winter.
What will this investment mean for the local economy, and what did Rachel Reeves have to say about it?
Well, Haven is already a big employer in the area, but the investment means an increase of 100 new jobs, and the Chancellor said that this showed there was confidence in the UK economy. She also said she recognised changes to the minimum wage and employers' national insurance had impacted businesses, but the government had put measures in place for small businesses to prevent them from being negatively impacted. She added the increase in minimum wage meant more money in people's pockets, which they would then spend in the local economy.
Okay, thanks, Rob.
Simon, what's going on at County Hall?
I've been using the quiet time at County Hall to reflect on the first 100 days of Reform since they came in charge of Kent County Council back in May. Lest we forget, they won 57 of the 81 seats, and it put them in overall charge of the authority, which, like all others in the country, faces some pretty stern challenges ahead. But as expected, with a brash young upstart, the party elected Lyndon Kemp-Caron as its leader. She's straight-talking, hard as nails, and has no time for wokery or political correctness, and is certainly not afraid of putting people's noses out of joint.
What stuck in your mind from the past 100 days?
Well, we barely said hello to the new leader when she was already courting controversy by banning the Ukrainian flag inside the chamber above County Hall. There was a massive hoo-ha over a Reform councillor claiming to have found a book about transgender issues in the children's section of a local library. This was stuff that the party leader, Nigel Farage, had claimed was poisoning the minds of children. But the most recent was Reform being accused of racism and transphobia over remarks made during a debate about the council's continued commitment to preventing violence towards women and girls. A motion had been tabled by the Green Party, and in what may have been a coordinated response designed to wind the Greens up, the leader, Lyndon Kemp-Caron, suggested that undocumented males coming into the country might be behind the surge in violence against females in society, and that women's safe spaces were being, as she said, invaded by men pretending to be women. I mean, there was a lot more besides, but it was all quite unedifying, and the Greens were disgusted and fuming and continued to be so. But a Kent Tory suggested to me that the reason they're keeping pretty quiet at the minute is because they're just leaving the left to have a scrap with the right wingers, and the Green Party motion, one backbencher suggested, played straight into Reform's hands. Reform said a lot of things designed to wind them up, and wind them up they did. But the Tories, according to this person, who's not a councillor, and said that this is probably a shrewd strategy because by the end of the year, Reform will have had to have prepared the budget, which is no mean feat, with insufficient money to pay for the services it must provide by law. And, well, they might not be quite so chipper then.
So who's winning?
Well, Reform are winning because they're there by numerical advantage in this early part of the administration. However, that numerical advantage may turn out to be a disadvantage. There are now rumblings, I'm told, and take this with a pinch of salt, among those who didn't get cabinet or deputy cabinet roles, of slight dissatisfaction about losing 5% of their £17,000 a year allowance at the behest of the leadership. I've no doubt that leader Lyndon Kemp-Caron is well aware of what is up ahead of her, and she's not going to get an easy ride from the opposition parties, but she won't miss any opportunity to push all their buttons either. Nikki, what's caught your eye this week?
It's actually an article of yours, Simon, and the reaction...
Was it?
It was. And reaction to the news that former Tory MP Adam Holloway has defected to Reform UK.
Well, our podcast last week, Adam Holloway, certainly raised a few eyebrows and prompted a few comments.
Yeah, he did. But it was inevitable, I guess. I mean, he's a well-known name and served Gravesham for a long time, 19 years, until he lost his seat to Labour's Dr. Lauren Sullivan last year. So there was always going to be plenty of people with a view. Now, while Reform UK leader Nigel Farage welcomed Mr. Holloway for making the move, which he described as bold, others think he's made a mistake. Now, as you know, you spoke to Damien Green. He lost his Ashford seat at the general election to Labour in July last year. He described Mr. Holloway as a really, really good bloke and a decent human being, but he felt that he had, in his words, hopelessly misjudged the situation. Now, Mr. Green said there were some people he'd have happily said goodbye to. He didn't name them. But Mr. Holloway wasn't one of them. He thought he'd been a brilliant constituency MP, but his political judgment on this was, as he described it, hopelessly out. Mm. Now, the former Tory Rochester and Strood MP, Kelly Tolhurst, she just said that she felt sad that Mr. Holloway had felt that he needed to leave the party. And Lord Craig McKinley, who used to be the MP for South Thanet, he said he too was upset to hear the news.
I know that Tom Tugendhat said he wouldn't miss Adam Holloway in a podcast appearance of yours, but what are Adam Holloway's former constituents in Gravesham saying about this?
Well, we took a quick snapshot of views and we found that there were some who were totally against the party, so they wouldn't be voting for Reform UK, whoever was standing, while others recognised that Mr. Holloway had done, you know, some quite hard work over the years and had been good for Gravesham. As I said, it was only a snapshot, so it'll be interesting to see what happens in the coming months.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Some say he's a soothsayer for the new millennium, a man who knows his FPTPs from his STVs, certainly his RRPs from his MRPs. Like many modern pollsters, Martin Baxter's electoral calculus is starting to prove the naysayers wrong who claim that you can't trust the polls anymore. After all, Mr. Baxter predicted Reform UK would win overall control of Kent County Council, a result absolutely no one, including me, gave any credence to. He's with us today. Martin Baxter, welcome.
Hello there, Simon.
Well, I have to hand it to you, Martin. Electoral Calculus teamed up with the Daily Telegraph a few months ago and found that Reform would probably win Kent County Council outright, and they did. Do you think that some people don't believe polls because they just don't want to?
Oh, well, I mean, there's all sorts of reasons to be sceptical of some polls. Not all polls are right, we know that, and sometimes at elections many polls are wrong. On the other hand, you are right that some people don't like the message from polls, and there's a little bit of shooting the messenger goes on as well. So that's just something we have to live with on our side.
Kent was not the only prediction. How did you get on with the other predictions in other parts of the country?
So on the whole, for the local elections, which are tricky to predict, it came out relatively well in the sense that we predicted big gains for Reform and losses for the Conservatives, and that was what happened. Not every detail was correct, but the broad picture was pretty good. So we marked that down as a relatively successful outing for polling and our MRP technology.
I was just going to come on to MRP. Electoral calculus uses this method, and it's known as multi-level regression and post-stratification, or MRP, whilst it sounds quite bad for you. Can you just outline, for the benefit of the listener, because it's probably new to them perhaps, how it actually works?
Yes, it's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? But what it really means is that when we do our poll, we ask people how they're planning to vote. We don't just count the number of people for each party, but we look at their characteristics. You know, what are men doing compared with women, young people compared with older people, people with university degrees, people without, and so on. And we build up a sort of set of profiles of the sorts of people who are more likely to vote for one party than another. And then we apply that to the actual people who live in a particular area, say in Kent, you know, what the age breakdown is and the education profile and so on. And because we know the links between the demographic characteristics and people's vote, we can get a more accurate idea of how voting is going to happen in an area like Kent, or indeed particular wards within Kent.
But you can make it really specific to right down to something as granular as a single ward.
We can go to single ward. We can almost go down to street level. A few years ago, we did a little exercise workout, which was the most left-wing street in Britain.
Oh, right.
Which turned out to be a nice leafy street in Brighton.
Of course. Well, yeah, that's quite possible.
And a friend of ours went up and down door stopping and found, yes, they were.
You actually went door to door in Brighton.
Another radio station did it for us. But yeah, they went door to door up the street and they found that they were essentially well-off Guardian readers voting Labour. So it worked pretty well.
Why is MRP proving to be as accurate as it is?
Well, it's not a magic bullet, but it has two things going for it. It tends to use larger samples. Normal polling operates usually with about a 2,000-person sample. MRP is normally 5,000 minimum and often larger than that. So it gets more people in it. And then it uses this more sophisticated analysis to, as I said, not just look at the counts of how many people are supporting each party, but what their characteristics are, and then uses that to make approximations for small areas. So it tends to be more accurate nationally, but it also gives you much finer geographical detail than classic polling could manage to do.
Okay.
Those are the two big advantages for our point of view.
Yeah. Reform UK took two more council seats in the Borough Council at Dartford in July. Are these midterm results significant in shifting the dial on your system?
Well, it certainly indicates that Reform is continuing to do well, that Reform's been doing quite well in by-election votes cast, so reflecting very much their continuing strong position in national opinion polls. So all the evidence, both from polls and by-elections, says that Reform are doing quite well. Though, admittedly, it's a very fractured political environment, that we've got Reform and Conservatives to the right of centre, and Labour, the Lib Dems, the Greens, and maybe Jeremy Corbyn's party on the left of centre. So the votes are split in lots of different directions. It's not the case that Reform are at 50% in the polls. They're at about 30% in the polls. But 30 is still bigger than anybody else. And under the first-past-the-post system, the party that gets more votes than anyone else, even if it's not getting a majority of votes, tends to do pretty well. And that's where Reform is at the moment. But nothing's guaranteed that, although that's the current state, things may change over the next few years, that Reform might explode or implode. The other parties, the left might get united or not. The Conservatives might have a resurgence. And then there's other technical factors like turnout and tactical voting can change the result away from what people expect as well. So the next election is frankly going to be pretty hard to predict. Okay. We're going to try. But it is going to be
okay. Well, I mean, the latest national prediction, and this came out last week, is yet more bad news for Labour and seemingly for the Tories, even worse news. You know, if the election, according to your prediction, is that Labour would be on 138 seats at Westminster, the Conservatives on 35, Reform on 347, which is a working majority of 44, I think, and the Lib Dems would be on roughly about 67. I mean, is there any precedent in history, or indeed anywhere, that a brand new party so far from an election can be this far ahead?
Well, you have to go back about 100 years when the new young Labour Party supplanted the old Liberal Party in vote share and seats. Though that process, it did take an election or two, I'd have to check on that, but they did, Labour did overtake the Liberals and became the second party. So if Reform overtake the Conservatives, which at the moment they are doing according to the polls, then that would be a once-in-a-century style event where the top two parties in British politics change.
Okay. And what effect do you think if Jeremy Corbyn does launch this party? We don't know what it's called yet. I think it's been nominally called the Your Party. What slice of the vote do you anticipate they will take, and where will it come from? Will it be both Labour and Green?
Well, there's not been a lot of polling on this so far. BMG did a poll earlier this week, and they had it at 6% support for the Jeremy Corbyn party. And I think that's would probably mostly come from Labour and the Greens, as you say. But it's early days. It's got off to a sort of relatively soft start, the Jeremy Corbyn party. As you say, the name's not even fully nailed down yet. So we'll have to wait and see a bit on that. The new parties are hard to get off the ground. We've seen a lot of people may remember, say, Change UK, the independent group.
That was a splinter group, yeah.
A splinter group of Labour tried to get started, but in the end faded away. So it is hard to get going. Nigel Farage has done it, and the Labour Party did it 100 years ago. Jeremy Corbyn obviously has got fairly strong name recognition, so he's on with a better chance. But, you know, the SDP, 40 years ago,
I remember
now, indeed, Roy Jenkins and David Owen and Shirley Williams and Bill Rogers split off from Labour. So that was four big names, and they had quite a lot of good publicity for a while. And I think there was at a stage where they were, was it 50% in the opinion polls? But it didn't last to the general election. So we will have to see. But the one advantage that Jeremy Corbyn has is that Labour is not very popular with many of its supporters. We did a poll on this, asking people to say in their own words what they were worried about with Labour. And they had some choice phrases, but the best one was, Labour are supposed to be left-wing, not Tories with red ties. So although maybe not all listeners might agree, many Labour supporters think the Labour government is too right-wing and they are looking for a more left-wing alternative. Mm. Jeremy Corbyn would fit that bill quite well. Equally, those people are probably a minority of the public, but there is an appetite for something to the left of Labour.
Interesting. And according to the latest predictions, which went up online at the beginning of the month, in Kent, only Tunbridge Wells, which would be Liberal Democrat, Canterbury would be a Labour / Independent in Rosie Duffield, and Tunbridge, which is Tom Tugendhat, those are the only ones which would not go to Reform. So 15 seats in Kent, which has always been regarded as blue could be. Is this a sort of existential predicament, or have parties climbed out of their way of the, or have parties managed to climb out of such a situation in the past?
Well, I said again, it's a long time to the next election. We've got maybe 4 years or so. So a lot could change. But at the moment, yes, Reform have taken over as the more popular party on the centre-right of British politics. And the map, it's not just Kent, it's throughout urban and rural England. Reform are currently predicted to pick up lots of seats, with the Conservatives reduced to fewer than the Liberal Democrats. So the Liberal Democrats still doing quite well in the sort of south and southwest of England, not so much in Kent. But Reform doing very well. This is not, there's not a lock on that. This is not destiny. It could well turn out to be different from that. But at the moment, that's the political situation.
Mm. It's interesting, actually, when you look at each constituency in Kent, the ones that were very, very narrow possible Reform victories, I mean, those are no longer narrow victories. They are quite substantial. They've gone from maybe 1.2% chance more than their nearest rival, up to 20-30% more chance of winning than before. So that suggests a lot of momentum going on.
Yes, Reform have crossed the big critical threshold of 30% support. They're at or above 30% support, and other parties are in the low 20s at best, Conservatives in the teens. If you're that many percent ahead of other parties, you are going to do very well in the electoral system. You're going to pick up a lot of seats. But the thing to remember is, although Reform very strong at the moment, a few changes in support could take much of that away. If Reform fell back to 25%, then the map would look much less light blue than it does. Equally, if they gain further than 30, it will be even more Reform. So there is a lot to play for. Yes, the Conservatives could come back, but it is Reform are ahead at the moment. But it is a volatile situation, and relatively small changes in support can lead to quite big changes in outcome. And another thing we've been thinking hard about is turnout. That at the last election, Conservative voters were more likely to turn out than they thought, but Labour and Reform voters were less likely to turn out than they estimated. And small technical little problems like that can make a big difference on the outcomes. So that's the thing to watch as well. The election may be won by whichever party has the most enthusiastic supporters.
It's interesting, actually, because in the May 1 elections for KCC, the County Council, what appeared to be happening at local polling stations, that people were turning up that they weren't expecting to turn up. There was an unseen congregation, if you like, of people who suddenly became motivated to vote, but they hadn't been identified before.
Yes, that sounds very plausible. Thanks for that. That, you know, local elections particularly have low turnout. So any party with enthusiastic voters, local elections can do very well. And general elections is similar as well. So the party with enthusiastic voters will win more seats than parties with less enthusiastic voters. And Reform's main benefit at the moment is that their voters are enthusiastic in the sense that they're motivated because they have become disenchanted with the big two parties. And supporters of the big two parties are themselves a bit disenchanted and feeling a little bit under the political weather. But it remains to be seen if that changes.
Okay. If Nigel Farage wasn't the leader of Reform UK, would the party be doing so well, do you think?
My guess is no, it would not. That Nigel Farage is one of those rare politicians who has, let's call it charisma, but he, although many people don't like him, many people do like him. And so like Boris Johnson, Tony Blair and Margaret Thatcher before him, he gets lots of votes because of who he is and the idea people have about him. So that if he were to, you know, without him, I don't think Reform would do as well. But Reform do have him and they are doing well.
Finally, you recently teamed up with the Daily Telegraph again to conduct a survey on mental health. What was that all about?
So we were looking at mental health, and obviously it's a subject which is sensitive and has to be treated respectfully, because many people have serious mental health problems and the public are overwhelmingly sympathetic to that. But we were also looking at the question about whether anybody exaggerates their mental health problems, or whether it's too easy to claim benefits for mental health problems on the benefit system. And we did get some interesting findings on that, that most people think that people often exaggerate their mental health problems. Most people also think it's too easy to claim benefits for mental health problems. And 3/4 of people think that some people mistake normal life ups and downs for mental illness. So it was a mixture of compassion and sympathy, but also a bit of skepticism that maybe there's too much claiming of mental health, or too much saying you have mental health problems.
How big was your sample?
That was over 2,000 people. So we did that last month.
Okay. Listen, fascinating to talk to you as always. Martin, thank you very much indeed again for your time today.
Thanks, Simon. Always a pleasure.
The government this week launched a scheme alongside the French to try and halt the record numbers of migrants arriving by small boats in Kent. The idea is that for every one person deemed to have entered the UK illegally, the authorities in France will swap that person for someone who's already made an asylum claim through the official channels over there. But Nikki, will it work?
Depends who you ask, as always, in politics. I mean, the trouble is, I think it's going to be really hard to say at any point if this scheme has been a success or not, although there will be many who try to argue from both sides. I mean, as of the 30th of July, more than 25,000 people had crossed the channel in small boats this year, and that's about 49% higher than at the same point last year. So how do you judge this? If the numbers drop over the coming months, is that because people have been put off making the crossings because of this deal, or were they just simply never going to make the the journey anyway, so the numbers would have dropped of their own accord. But if we go the other way and we see numbers double, is that because the new system is failing, or would you have seen numbers triple without it being in place? You're never going to know, which means this debate is never going to end until there's been a long period of time where there have been no crossings at all by boat, and I don't think that's ever going to happen. Now, the scheme has barely got underway and people are already criticising the anticipated numbers. It's been reported that there'll be about 50 people a week could be sent to France. Now, that's a stark contrast to the more than 800 people every week who arrive in the UK on small boats. It's just a tiny percentage, but, you know, if you're desperate to make a new life here because of the horror you've left behind in your own country, you're probably still going to hop on a boat. But the government's got to start somewhere, hasn't it?
It's not actually meant to be the only solution to the small boats crisis. What the government, I think, appear to be trying to do is to disincentivise people from making the journey in the first place, and thus undermining the business model of the people smugglers.
Absolutely, and you've got to make a start, but there is going to be a lot of people who are going to say it's not enough. You know, it's just not going to happen. Now, at the moment, there's no legal way to travel into the UK for the specific purpose of seeking asylum. And I think that what people forget is that huge numbers of these people who, if they're granted the right to stay, they'll probably go on to make a real positive contribution to this country. I mean, the Refugee Council points out that there's 1,200 medically qualified refugees recorded on the British Medical Association's website. I mean, how is that not helping our country improve itself? At the end of the day, we're largely talking about people who are fleeing persecution, and they need our help.
Well, these days, it's not just persecution, it's famine. And famine brings war.
Absolutely. It's terrible, terrible conditions that you and I can't even contemplate.
Well, I've spent a lot of time in Calais over the years, and I've heard the stories, and, you know, I can't say that, you know, sometimes when you read things and hear things about how these people are being demonised, when you actually meet them, they're actually the most courteous, well-mannered and decent people. But
yeah, you
don't know who they are. You don't really know who they are. And I think that's the point that especially Reform UK is trying to make, that we don't know who these people are. And it's not a great system for immigration of any kind. Dan, what are your thoughts on this?
It's not going to work. I'm quite confident predicting that. The first problem,
I think, being, I agree with you, actually.
The first problem being that, so the people under the rules, people can only be removed from the country under the one in, one out thing if their asylum claim has already been processed, which comes back to the fundamental problem. The problem we have in this country is the processing of asylum claims and the basis on which we process them. We don't have enough people making decisions, and the British judiciary and, you know, legal system has, compared to the rest of Europe, profoundly liberal and expansive interpretations of European human rights law, which is why we approve, you know, such a significant amount of asylum claimants, which in other countries wouldn't even have a leg to stand on. You know, a couple of years ago, it was revealed that we're one of the only countries which accepts asylum claims from Albania, by all means a safe country, and, you know, there's no civil war there, organised crime is a problem.
But that's been blocked.
I think we might be one of the only countries which accepts asylum claims from Vietnam as well, where, you know, more credible case of political persecution, but not the same as people coming from, say, Syria or Afghanistan. So all of these things, one in, one out systems, all of that are essentially ways of the government avoiding the single fundamental question of asylum and immigration, which is what is the legal basis on which you decide whether somebody has a right to claim asylum? And the answer is the European Convention on Human Rights. And if you want to put any significant stop to the number of people who come here, many of whom only 20 years ago would never have been considered asylum seekers or refugees or have any chance of claiming asylum legitimately in any safe country. If you want to change that and reduce the number of people coming here illegally and claiming asylum, there is essentially only one option, and it's either leaving the ECHR or reforming British interpretation of it. And the government won't do that because, you know, human rights law is their thing.
Yeah, I heard on the news this morning that there are human rights lawyers rubbing their hands in sweaty glee at the thought of the latest initiative from the government.
Yeah, it keeps them going. There's a huge legal infrastructure of people who basically make their money on fighting asylum claims. Yeah. Once you reach this country and you place an asylum claim,
you have
huge avenues of appeal. It's, you know, and it's the go-to claim for, you know, not even just arriving on small boats, people who arrive for other means of illegal immigration. You come here on a student visa or a temporary work visa, disappear into the dark economy illegally, working in low-wage, low-skill industries. If you're ever found out, claim asylum, your chances of leaving the country or ever being moved from the country are minimal to none. So, you know, all of these things are avoidances of the main question, which is the legal definition of asylum and the rights of people to claim it. And, you know, the only way to change that is the ECHR.
Okay, folks, that's your lot for this week. Thanks to Dan, Robert and Nikki for their contributions, and to special guest Martin Baxter. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage. And you can also sign up for our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m.
or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.